Welcome to the Fourth Estate Podcast with Marty Durin, where we examine how the American media are failing the American people. Bad reporting, clickbait headlines, and outright lies will come under scrutiny. Why? Because facts matter. Now, with this edition of the Fourth Estate Podcast, here's your host, Marty Durin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Fourth Estate Podcast. This is Marty Durin, coming to you live from the Master Bedroom Closet, where I'm recording this in hopefully one take. This is the first podcast. This is the fourth attempt to get the first segment together. There's going to be a lot of ums and so's and uhs, more than likely, because I don't have time to go back and try to edit again. I am the host, the sound technician, the studio producer, the audio technician. I'm everything that it takes to make this podcast run. And I'm out of time to get all the editing done for this particular episode, with it being the inaugural episode. So I want to warn you on that. Hopefully it'll be entertaining and informative nonetheless. I really appreciate you taking the time to join me this day or this night or this afternoon or this morning, whenever you might happen to be listening. I had the idea of this podcast at the behest of a friend of mine about 3 months ago, who suggested, because of my interest in accurate reporting, that I might start a podcast. I do this a lot on my Facebook page, especially when I see things that come through my Facebook feed that are somewhat less than truthful or somewhat less than accurate. And there's a lot of emotion that plays into headlines. There's a lot of response that is sought from people who write headlines. They find images that are very appealing. And so a lot of these things get shared, many of them thousands and thousands of times. And so I would see these come through my newsfeed, and I would be sometimes aghast at the things that people would share, sometimes honestly believing that things were true. And so I made kind of a habit. It was fun, but I felt like it was important also that people would understand the truth and the reason and the importance, I should say, of making sure that what we're sharing on social media and elsewhere, whether it's email or whatnot, is accurate, and not just share it because it affirms some political or religious viewpoint that we have. It actually doesn't affirm anything if it's inaccurate. So this man, Dan Cassis, encouraged me to consider a podcast and deal with some of these issues. And so I took him at his request, or his challenge, I should say. And so I spent a couple of 3 months getting ready. This is the inaugural edition of the Fourth Estate Podcast. As I was getting ready for the podcast and getting equipment together and talking to people at my work, I'm not a journalist. I'm a social media manager by trade and a pastor, a part-time pastor. And people would ask me, especially at my full-time job, well, what are you going to call the podcast? And I didn't know at first. I threw the idea out on Facebook one day and got, I don't know, dozens of suggestions, none of which were usable, few of which were serious in any way whatsoever. But I had read in the past that the press or the media has been referred to as the Fourth Estate. Edmund Burke in London, this would have been 200 years ago or more, is credited with utilizing that term first of all, and the Fourth Estate in his mind provided a check or a system of checks and balances for those who were in power. At the founding of our country, as our founding fathers were considering the role of the press, eventually, as we know now, there were protections given in the First Amendment, but even the founders were not sold. They weren't in agreement on what kinds of freedom the press should have. What should newspapers be allowed to publish without some kind of approval? Where was the safety for the reporter or for the newspaper, the editor? In many cases, the editor and the reporter were the same person. James Madison is quoted as saying, The security of the freedom of the press requires that it be exempt not only from previous restraint of the executive, as in Great Britain, but from legislative restraint also. So I'm going to stop the quote there for just a second. What he's saying is there should be no prior restraint doctrine where the a newspaper would need to go and get the approval of the president before writing a story or publishing a story. Getting a comment or getting a response would be one thing, but prior restraint would mean that the president or the monarch, whoever, wherever this was, but in our country, the president would have the ability to stop such a thing, the legislative branch as well. So he addresses the legislative branch as well. And he says that they should be exempt. And then I'm continuing the quote. And this exemption, not only from the previous inspection of licensors, but from the subsequent penalty of laws. And now I'm ending the quote. So Madison's argument was that newspapers should not have to get permission. They should not need to get clearance from either the executive branch or the legislative branch before they could write a story. And then when they wrote the story, they should not be able to be condemned or castigated or penalized in some way by the legislative branch or the executive branch. Now, as the country has rolled on, of course, there are some prohibitions, slander and libel and things like that. But on the whole, the press is considered free. Now, we've had freedom of the press for so long that in our country, a lot of people, you know, it's degenerated to where it's, you know, TMZ or People Magazine or Us Magazine. And we think of freedom of the press so often as just the ability to write or publish and everything's protected. But the press and a free press is foundational to democracy. It's not simply we can publish what we want to. Now, I love freedom of the press because as a blogger, I'm afforded the same freedoms as the New York Times, the same protections as the New York Times, and I can publish what I want. I don't have to get permission from anyone. I'm subject to the same penalties if I lie or slander or something like that. A person's name or their reputation, if the big boys and the big girls are protected, then I'm protected. And if they're not protected, then there's no protection for me either. So I'm glad for the freedom of the press. But freedom of the press is foundational to democracy. In the book, or at least the paper, Introduction, Journalism in the Digital Age from Stanford, I see this this quote in the introduction. The fact of the matter is that democracy requires informed citizens. No governing body can be expected to operate well without knowledge of the issues on which it is to rule, and rule by the people entails that the people should be informed. In a representative democracy, the role of the press is twofold. It both informs citizens and sets up a feedback loop between the government and the voters. End of quote. So democracy depends upon the people of the republic or the people of the democracy being able to get accurate information. And so the press is protected so that it's not supposed to be protected to protect the government. It's supposed to be protected to protect our ability to get accurate information about the government. The Fourth Estate was to hold the other three branches accountable, at least in our country. The legislative branch, the judicial branch, and the executive branch were supposed to be held accountable by the press. So whatever the government did, the president or the legislators or the supremes, whatever they did was subject to investigative reporting. It was subject to be front page news. And by these newspapers and by the reporters and by the wire services, there was supposed to be a protection for us, who are the citizens, not all of whom live in Washington, D.C., and certainly in the earlier days of our country when we didn't have internet, we didn't have telephone, we didn't have television, we didn't have radio, and it took many, many days sometimes for news to get all the way across the country. There was a protection that no matter where you lived, if you could get the information, you could know what was going on with the government, and hopefully it was an accurate story written by a reputable source that you could know what had happened to Lincoln or what had happened to Taft or what had happened to Carter or to Reagan or to one of the Bush presidents. And so That's what took place. And so there was this protection, but the protection was not for the government. It was for us on our behalf. In 1971, in an opinion given in the case of New York Times versus the United States, and I think this might have been the Pentagon Papers, Supreme Court Justices Black and Douglas, in their opinion, wrote this: the press was to serve the governed, not the governors. The government's power to censor the press was abolished so that the press would remain forever free to censure the government. The press was protected so it could bear the secrets of government and inform the people. So the freedom of the press was established in the First Amendment, not because we wanted to have magazines and not because we wanted to have trivial information spread from sea to shining sea. But the purpose of the press was to give us the information that we needed to protect the democracy that the founders had founded, to protect the republic that the founders had founded. And they believed that for us to be able to sustain the government, to sustain the republic, that it was imperative that we have access to what was going on in the seats of government, what was going on with the president, what was going on with the legislature, what was going on with the courts. And so the press was protected so they could write exactly what was happening without fear of being thrown into jail for it. Now, it goes without saying that things have changed over the years. We do not live in the same kind of freedom of the press atmosphere that we lived in for many, many years through the founding of this country. Now, if you read back or even watch movies that are based in some of those old, old settings, you'll find out that there was often a calamitous relationship between the press, which sometimes was just one dude. He was the editor and owner of the local paper, and some land baron or some mayor or some governor. It wasn't always a good relationship. Today, sometimes it's a little too cozy. And so I'm going to come back in just a minute after I've talked about who's sponsoring this program. And we're going to talk about some of the issues that we're facing with the press today. This first episode of The Fourth Estate is being brought to you by some of my friends who believed in what I was doing here. They encouraged me to do it, but not only encouraged me to do it, they actually provided finances and equipment for me to be able to record this podcast and taught me some things to be able to get it online where people could actually listen to it. Shel Scott and John Elam and Keith Sewell, who are friends, they actually bought equipment from my Amazon wish list, and all of the equipment that they purchased I am using right now as I record this podcast, and I want to say thanks to them for doing that. The intro voice, the outro voice that you heard, the voiceover work, is by Dan Cassis. If there's something unclear about it, if it sounds fuzzy, it's the compression. It's not Dan. Dan's a fantastic voiceover artist. He's done audiobooks. He's done commercial work, I think. And later on, several episodes down the way, he'll still be sponsoring me, and I'll be able to give you some contact information if you have a podcast or you have an audiobook that you'd like to get, or a book that you'd like to turn into an audiobook. He does great, great work there. Todd Littleton is a blogging buddy for many, many years, and actually a good friend, not just a blogging buddy. And he gave me some encouragement. He gave me some tips on how to get some stuff done. And then last but not least, my good friend Jonathan Howe, who is a podcaster extraordinaire. He's a podcast host of a top 300 podcast nationally, maybe even worldwide, I'm not sure, but on iTunes anyway. And he taught me a lot about the editing process and the recording process, the uploading process. So their wisdom has pitched in a lot for this inaugural episode for sure, and then ongoing as well. So I'm really appreciative of them. I think it goes without saying that many, many people really feel like the media is not doing well. We feel like that there's errant reporting. When the Boston bombing happened, and CNN jumped right out front with really bad information that they repeated several times. And we know that used to be there were correction pages on major newspapers, and a lot of time corrections now just go by the wayside. There's very rarely a huge retraction, although Rolling Stone recently had one. in the Virginia rape case. And so there's a lot of doubt, there's a lot of distrust about media, and it's not without good reason. It really does not take a lot to see that there's such a competitive environment in the media, and there's such a strong fight for advertising dollars, especially for online media, for those clicks. Everybody needs to get the clicks so they can get the advertising dollars. So that runs us into the situation where you have titles to articles that are really, really hinky, and they may or may not have anything to do with the article itself. We're going to examine one of those in segment three. We have what we call clickbait, which is you won't believe what happened next, and things like just watch this. This is so cute, and you're going to cry. I cried a million tears. Those types of things just for the purpose of getting you to click that link and go to that page, and all those clicks together wind up for advertising dollars for the hosts of those pages or those sites. And so a lot of what's happening recently has to do with these things that are designed. The story is nothing, generally speaking. Sometimes it's a 2-minute video of a dog falling downstairs or something like that, or some guy getting, you know, whacked in the head with a plastic baseball bat or something. And so much of it is really just nothing. Some of it's interesting, but it certainly isn't life-changing or world-changing. And so we're in a situation where so much media is trivial. Another issue that we face is that all the major media, especially in the United States, I can't say for worldwide, but all the major media in the United States and an enormous amount of the secondary media are corporately owned. It's a corporate media environment where MSNBC is not just advertising, or is not just a news outlet or a media outlet that is left leaning. Fox News is not just a media outlet that is right leaning. They depend on those audiences. They have to go with the lean that they have, and sometimes have to lean and lean and lean because they have to get more and more audience members who are of that particular political viewpoint so that they can continue to get more viewers and more dollars. So even if we have freedom of the press, it does not guarantee accuracy in reporting. And I think we all know this, but it's important to understand that it's a corporate media environment. It's not a reporter's media environment. I think the issue a lot of times is not with the reporters themselves. I think the issue is the way what the system has evolved into has created a condition that makes it difficult for necessary stories to bubble to the top, and makes it necessary for unimportant or biased or leaning stories to continue to be promoted, so that the same people be drawn back, and the same flavor of people, or the same lean of people, the same persuasion of people will be coming back over and over again in order to get those clicks, to get those advertising dollars, to satisfy the stockholders and the analysts and all that kind of thing. So media today is much more, it's much more involved than just getting a story. And so I think we have to really, really be aware of that. Corporate sponsorship or corporate ownership of the media and dependent on ad dollars has created a really precarious situation when it comes to trying to get truth, because truth is the casualty. If truth is the first casualty of war, then it certainly is a casualty in the media war. Scott McClellan is a former press secretary. He was in the Bush 43 White House, I think, for about 3 years. And he wrote a book called What Happened that talked about how the Bush White House related to the media and the narratives related to the Iraq War. But he noticed this during his time in the White House. He was concerned that, and quote, the national media is overemphasizing controversy. The excessive focus on who is winning and who is losing in Washington, and the constant search for something or someone to pick on and attack. These bad habits too often cause the larger truths that matter the most to get lost in the mix. End of quote. And I'll tell you that I think I stumbled over a couple of words there and maybe even left one out. But that's from Scott McCullen's book, What Happened. So We don't have the Office of Propaganda in Washington. There's not a section of the White House in the West Wing that is the Office of Propaganda. But there is a real sense in which every administration hopes to use the media to get a particular narrative into the public that is only investigated later on. And it may be years before an investigative story is done, long after that president is out of the White House or well into his or her second term in the White House, where no real political damage can be done. And so the media, I mean, we see the press secretary, and there's sometimes this enormous amount of grilling that takes place. But just think, when's the last time a major policy-changing, politically wind-shifting story came out of the press room of the White House? It may have happened at some point, but it's unlikely that it's going to happen very often, because that is a controlled environment where the press secretary is doing everything in his or her power to control the way that information comes out, so that when those reporters who are gathered there go back and they file their stories, that the slant of the story is neither isn't determined by what the outlet wants it to be, if the White House can help it, but it has the narrative that the White House wants it to happen. This is every White House, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. Their goal is to get their story out in the first election cycle of the administration. The first term, they want to be reelected. In the second term, if they get reelected, they want to help all their buddies get reelected in the midterm. And then in the next election for the next president, they want it to be their party, and they want it to be their party's people who are coming into the houses of Congress. So the White House is complicit, always. Every White House is complicit in getting information into the media that isn't always accurate, so that they can continue to put their narrative forward, so that the press then is so busy, they're so antagonistic with each other, there's competition with each other, and then they don't always get around to examining in depth what the White House is saying. Don't have time to go into, but if you can pick up a copy of Gary Webb's book, Dark Alliance, there's a tremendous example there of how one investigative reporter from California was able to find a significant story. This is way back in the 80s. Was able to find a significant story that painted the White House, then the Reagan White House, in a terrible light, and the length to which the White House went with involving the Washington Post and New York Times and LA Times to try to get Webb discredited was remarkable. And so it was all about controlling that storyline and trying to get the narrative to be that which would cause the White House to look the best. So that's a little bit about what we're dealing with media. There's thousands of things more that could be said, I'm sure. But as we as Americans consider the media, we think about the media, we consume media, we cannot forget that it's corporately owned, that political forces attempt to control how narratives come into the public arena, even through the press, that reporters don't always have time to fact check every single thing that comes to them, that stories are put out that sometimes are not corrected for many weeks, or in some cases even years after things have already been written and people have already believed one thing over another thing. And so all of these things come together to create dynamics that, if we aren't careful and if we aren't attentive and if we aren't diligent to fact check and to check multiple sources, and sometimes, you know, thank God for the internet, because we can check sources in Egypt or in Iraq or in Iran, the free press in some of those areas, to find out what's going on the ground, who's doing what there. When Israel and Gaza are in a fight, we don't have to watch NBC necessarily to see what's going on. We can we can go to Twitter or we can go to more local news sources and we can find out things that are happening on the ground. So it's a great time to be alive from that perspective. It's a great time to be involved in media, even if you're just a news junkie. My encouragement is to get it right. So I'm going to take a very brief break that may have some kind of sound effect in it just to provide some space. And then we're going to come back to a segment that I actually recorded about 2 weeks ago. So if the volume level's different or something sounds different in the recording, that's what that's about. I didn't fall asleep or something like that. But it's been fun, and I hope you'll hang around for what's left. A couple of days ago, I saw an article come across my newsfeed, and it said this: Obama compares himself to Jesus at Christmas celebration, from a site called MrConservative.com. When I saw the headline, I thought, oh man, that is just not good. And so my second thought was, oh man, maybe that's just not even what happened, because there are so often the case that headlines are used in such a way to draw people's attention to get the click. We talked about clickbait a little bit in the first segment. The headline is so outlandish that immediately people's emotions are inflamed. And when your emotions get inflamed, you almost can't not do something. And so people will click on stories like this. So I clicked on it to see what was going on, almost certain that it wasn't the case. Well, there was a video embedded on the site, on the particular page. The headline across the video actually said, again, Obama compares himself to Jesus at Christmas celebration. It looked like that particular video had been lifted from a different website, because there was not only the host of the website and the cutaway, the split screen to Obama speaking, but there was also this terrible monotonous voiceover, additional commenting that was added during and before and after the guy who was on the video talking and President Obama as he was talking. So I watched the video, which was a couple of minutes long, and it was from this year's National Christmas Tree Lighting Ceremony. And the president was talking about this singularly significant child, I think may have been his wording, who had come to the earth some 2,000 years ago. Well, the host that was on the video, which wasn't the owner of MrConservative.com, I don't think, but the video that had been posted from the original broadcast, continued to pause the video, and interject comments encouraging the president, really ragging on the president, to say the name Jesus, which he obviously would have been better off by saying the name Jesus, but he chose not to for whatever reason. The problem is, nowhere in the video was there any indication that Mr. Obama had compared himself to Jesus. And so I went to YouTube and found the original speech that was on the White House channel that was uncut. It was unedited. It included the reading of the Christmas story by Michelle Obama and maybe one of her daughters, the lighting of the tree, the president thanking the people who were involved. So there were White House volunteers or White House employees. There were kids who had provided Christmas trees. It was Tom Hanks who did something. I don't even know what he did. And so there were all these miscellaneous thank yous that went along with the presentation. And so after the presentation and after the thank yous and after some of the cutting up that was taking place between he and some of the other people involved, he got down to the part about why they were doing any of that stuff to begin with. So that part of his talk is about 2 minutes long or so. So I'm going to play that right now. And then we'll come back and we'll have a comment or two, and then we'll be closed.
But while lighting the tree has entered into the 21st century, the story that we remember this season dates back more than 2,000 years. It's the story of hope, the birth of a singular child into the simplest of circumstances, a child who would grow up to live a life of humility and kindness and compassion, who traveled with a message of empathy and understanding, who taught us to care for the poor and the marginalized and those who are different from ourselves. And more than two millennia later, the way he lived still compels us to do our best to build a more just and tolerant and decent world. It's a story dear to my family as Christians, but its meaning is one embraced by all peoples across our country and around the world, regardless of how they pray or whether they pray at all. and that's to love our neighbors as ourselves, to be one another's keepers, to have faith in one another, and in something better around the bend, not just at Christmas time, but all the time. And finally, this Christmas, we count our blessings and we give thanks to the men and women of our military who help make those blessings possible. And as we hold our loved ones tight, let's remember the military families whose loved ones are far from home. They are our heroes, and they deserve our heartfelt gratitude and our wholehearted support. So on behalf of Michelle, Malia, Sasha, mom-in-law, and our reindeer, Bo and Sonny, I want to wish all of them, and I want to wish all of you, a very, very Merry Christmas and a holiday filled with joy. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America.
Okay, so 2 minutes of talking about a singular person who had a unique life, whose life was very influential, who was born 2,000 years ago, who was the reason we celebrate, because my family are Christians, because it's Christmas time. This is a Christmas tree. I want to wish everyone a very merry, merry Christmas. I want to thank our troops. I want God to bless our troops. We're protected because of our troops. And nowhere at all in the entire speech did Obama compare himself to Jesus in any way, shape, or form. So this is the kind of thing that people who are followers of Jesus should be concerned about, because these are lies. We are supposed to be people of truth. We are supposed to be, we believe the truth sets you free. We believe that Jesus is the truth and the truth sets you free. So just aside from the fact that we as citizens can make better decisions when we know the truth, aside from the fact that democracy functions better when the citizenry is informed, besides the fact that the government is going to be a better government if the press actually operates as the fourth estate, those of us who call ourselves followers of Christ, we purport regularly that we are concerned about truth. We are concerned that people know the truth. We are concerned that people know the truth about Jesus, about the kingdom of God. We cannot fall victim to this kind of nonsense that encourages people to make bad decisions, to make uninformed decisions. The link to this post is going to be on my resource page. All you have to do is read down through the comments on that post, and you will see that the vast majority of people who read the headline did not watch the video. They clicked on the headline, they went directly to the comments, and started commenting as if the president had actually compared himself to Jesus, which he had not done. So the first, 20 or 25 comments are just off the rails about what he did not even say before somebody finally came in and said, "Did any of you guys even watch the video? I watched the video. He doesn't even say that." And that guy just gets absolutely pummeled. This is the Fourth Estate. This is what we'll be doing every week, hopefully. We'll go uploaded every Friday morning to iTunes, Stitcher, or you can listen and subscribe at the blog. Thanks for joining. I hope you have an awesome, awesome weekend.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Fourth Estate Podcast with Marty Duren. Visit Marty's blog, Kingdom in the Midst, at martyduren.com, and follow him on Twitter, @MartyDuren. We invite you to subscribe to the Fourth Estate Podcast on iTunes.